I find it very hard to watch myself on screen, although like I force myself to because sometimes I feel like I learn from it. So I use it as, you know, a training ground in a way. A lot of times you don't get paid for what you do because it takes so many auditions to even book a single job, but there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that go into it, and you're working long hours. You can't even remember your name, let alone your lines. Sometimes you're working in inclement weather. It's not as sexy as people think. You know, they look at the outside and they think it's bright and it's shiny, but there's a lot beneath the surface.
You're listening to part two of my awesome conversation with Danielle Vasanova, an actor, producer, entrepreneur, avid equestrian, and drummer. If you haven't yet listened to part one, be sure to check that one out first. Without further ado, here's part two with the amazing Danielle Vasanova.
So you talk about spiraling, right? One thing leads to the next. So Young and Restless, boom, you know, dream, this shit never happens, but it happened to you. Great role. What happened next?
I had to find an agent and find a manager, and then reality hit, you know, so it wasn't just, you know, boom, 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 everything is gravy, everything is puppy dogs and ice cream. It's like, no, now the work starts, right? Now I've really got to figure this out, and if I want to do this, I need to get a good team and start auditioning and bump the grind.
Well, you had The Young and the Restless on your resume right out of the gate. It was...
Yeah, so I got Taft Hartley like you did.
Right. I mean, right? That show, for, you know, for those people who don't know, started in 1973. It had been on the air now 50 years exactly. 15,000 shows. And for 32 years, it was the number one soap opera in the United States consecutively.
Not too shabby.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And that's your first building block on your resume.
Yeah.
So was it easy
it's
to get
like
it?
Kind of like working with Sharon Stone, you know?
Well.
Not quite. Yours is cooler.
Well, you actually got paid for yours. I mean,
I did. You didn't get paid?
Oh, I did. I made whatever the Taft Hartley was. I think it was $700 or something
like
that.
Yeah, like scale for the day, yeah.
Yeah, and I get residual checks. I'm not exaggerating, and I'm not bragging about this, but my last residual check, 21 cents.
Oh, yeah. I think I've literally gotten... a 1 cent check before. I'm like, why?
You have
why?
To deposit it just on principle.
it caused them more to send it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to, right?
Right. So, mm-hmm. Okay, reality sets in. I mean, you had the big show, but was it super easy to get an agent?
No, and I went through a series of managers and a series of agents after that. You know, I didn't know. Like, I thought that you get an agent and get your manager, and that's who you work with, and that's your team. I didn't know that, you know, you kind of roll through it.
How long was it before you got your next role? And what were you doing during that time to keep yourself busy and keep your mental sanity?
Exactly. No, I got a job. There was a restaurant in Sunset Plaza called Clef Loutis.
Okay.
This French restaurant.
Yeah.
And I got a job there. But when I was living in Van Nuys, I tripped and I fell down the stairs and I broke my toe. And so then I couldn't work at Clef Loutis anymore. And so I got a job just like being an extra and wearing shoes on my one foot that were two sizes too big for me, just so that my toe would fit in it. And I just told the AD, I'm like, look, just can you put me in the back like reading a book or something? Because I can't do these crosses. I can't do these passes, you know? And so that's how, because I needed to make money, I needed to pay the bills. And so that's how I paid my rent for a little while. And if I could, you know, if they would send me out for an audition, I'd have to go and, you know, miss work and go audition and try to juggle.
So sometimes things come up very quickly. You got to act super quickly.
Yeah.
You got to be ready. So tell us about this call you got at, I think it was from your agent, Jeannie Baccarat, if I have the name right, getting your passport together.
No, you're funny that you knew that. Yeah, no, I got a call, I think it was on a Friday, and it was a last minute audition. And I hustled through traffic, I went to this casting, I decided to play this character just like kind of off the wall, and I put a piece of gum in my mouth, and she was real edgy. And she kind of, I could see her kind of clock me, like she liked what I did. And then she's like, okay, do this.
Go back for a second, because you're way past the story of, let's slow-mo the story.
Okay.
You had never seen the script, you had never read for the script, and you had to audition, and then...
It was an NBC show. They sent me the sides, but it was same-day audition.
Same-day audition, right.
Yeah, okay, so I didn't have a lot of time to prep it.
Okay.
You know, so I was kind of just flying by the seat of my pants.
Okay, and your hair was blonde, so talk to us about that.
My hair was blonde, yeah. I was going through some you know, quarter-life crisis, and I was like, oh, I'm dyeing my hair blonde, like, you know, screw it, da-da-da. And so, yeah, they dyed it bleach blonde. Actually, that was for a job. And then, but my hair was fried. It was so fried. It looked horrible. Anyway, and so, yeah, I just like put it up in a ponytail and I put a piece of gum in my mouth and I created this character. And so I kind of did a cold read. She gave me an adjustment. I did it again. She's like, okay, now lose the gum. And then I did it again. She's like, okay, that was it. Left the room. They call me at like, my manager calls me at like 6 o'clock. He's like, your passport's up to date, right? And I said, yeah. He goes, you got the job. You're going to South Africa on Sunday. I was like, oh, what? That's the day after tomorrow. He's like, pack your bags. You're going. And it was one of the most magical, crazy, cool experiences of my life. And I totally thought that was it, you know? And then I was off to the races and I went to the airport and I remember Paulo, I can never say his name right, Paulo Coelho?
Yeah.
From The Alchemist?
Yep.
I saw this book on the Barnes & Noble bookshelf at the airport, and it said, The Winner Stands Alone. And I remember feeling like that. I remember feeling like, wow, I'm on this NBC show going to, you know, a foreign land, and I'm by myself, and what's going to happen? And I felt so grateful and so excited, but also, like, very lonely. Because I didn't know anybody, and I didn't know what I was walking into. So it was kind of scary. It was cool, but it was very scary for me.
So the fright was, you're going to a movie set, you don't know anybody, and you're afraid of being alone, and you're afraid of being isolated?
Yeah, I mean, excited, but also kind of scared. You know, I just felt like that book, The Winner Stands Alone. I felt like, wow, this is a great triumph for me, but I'm... Like, where is everyone? You know, it's just me.
So that was a pivotal moment in your career.
Yeah.
And then from there, you've worked on and off for a while.
I thought I would just be back to back. Like, I thought the offers would be coming in and it was just going to go crazy. And then I think I didn't work for almost 4 or 5 months after I got back. Just crickets. And that's how it is. It just kind of ebbs and flows. Nothing is guaranteed.
So how do you plan your life?
Exactly. My question, exactly.
With that, I mean, financially.
Exactly.
Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, did you buy a house at this point? Or were you thinking of just keeping the expenses low, just saving for a rainy day? I mean...
Yeah, I've always... I mean, I grew up with nothing, and so I've always kind of been like a little squirrel. And so I'm used to living... pretty close to the vest, and so I just kept my nose to the grindstone and just kept on.
You had jobs on and off, and you want to continue to act, continue to make money, continue to build your career. I remember a friend of my wife's was an actress. The only parts she could get were parts in her husband's movies.
Mm-hmm.
Then she had a chance to be on Melrose Place.
Okay.
The first Melrose Place.
Okay.
The one that was super popular. Erin Spelling, biggest producer.
Who'd she play?
She had a chance. And didn't take it.
Stop it.
Because it was too lowbrow for her. She was a real actress and didn't want to be on the show. I mean, Erin Spelling at that point was
biggest. That show went on forever.
Forever. Residuals.
She would have made tons, yeah.
Famous. Could get lots of roles. But she was worried about not getting roles and not being treated seriously mm-hmm. as an actress.
Right.
and was just high on her horse. She couldn't recognize, by the way, that the only part she got were her husband's movies, but this was a huge opportunity. It wasn't him, and she said no.
And so they offered her the part?
They offered her the part.
Wow.
And she turned it down.
Wow. Does she regret that?
I haven't talked to her, and I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine she didn't regret it. But sometimes you say no to movies. You said no to the Danica Patrick movie, and the answer is why? Tell us about the movie. Why'd you say no?
It's weird. Danica Patrick has come up a couple times in my life. They wanted to groom me to be a jockey, actually, before I got into acting. And they said to me, oh, we want to make you like the Danica Patrick of horse racing. I didn't do that because, you know, when I went to the barn and I talked to some of the other jockeys and some of the trainers, it's not if you're going to get hurt, it's when. And you have to be a 106 strip, so you're a 120 with the tack, and you have to make weight, and it's a lot of pressure. And so I said no to being a jockey and being kind of the Danica Patrick of horse racing because of that. You know, and maybe I would want to go on and have a family one day. And I figured, you know, I don't know, maybe that wasn't the best career path. But there was another Danica Patrick movie that I did want to do. And the whole movie ended up falling apart. I don't know if it was because she didn't win this one of the races. And so they wouldn't have this, you know, climactic end to the movie. I think they wanted her to be a little bit further on in her career. And so in the development phase, it just fell apart. But I would have done that.
So let's switch gears, talk about challenges. We've all had challenges in our life. We talked about
We've been talking about the challenges.
Okay.
All of these are challenges.
More serious challenges, right? I told you about my health scare.
Yes.
And how you come out of there, and I'm grateful.
You could not be here right now.
The crazy thing about that is a woman that I knew that I was friends with, that we worked together when I was a lawyer way back at the beginning of my career, I got out of the hospital and she died 5 days later. Mm. I went to her funeral and I thought, oh my God, like this could be my funeral. Mm. And I learned later that she died of myocarditis.
Stop.
You know, yeah, she'd gone running.
Same thing.
And it was rare. It was weird. And I remember being at her funeral, and she had 5-year-old twins, and her husband just, you know, couldn't even speak.
How quickly does it escalate? Does it come on fast, or does it take years?
She went on a run and came back and didn't wake up. She said she was really tired, and she came back and didn't wake up. In my case, it just felt like a flu that was getting worse and worse and worse. Mm. Where, you know, shit, something's seriously wrong. Mm. But you had something seriously wrong with you as well. Tell us the story about how you died for 3 minutes.
12/12/2019. Died. 3 minutes. The doctors couldn't tell. My mom flew in from New York. They couldn't tell her that I was going to live. I went to downtown LA. I went to urgent care, and because I kind of was feeling like I had a cold, and so they did a bunch of tests, and they said that I had strep, and sent me home with a Z-Pack. And then cut to the next day, I was supposed to go to Vegas to do a commercial for MGM, and I had actually asked my uncle Rob to. My brother lives in Vegas, and I had asked my uncle Rob to come out and take care of him because he has kidney stones. And he needed to get his kidney stones blasted, and so he needed help. And I wasn't there, because I was here in LA. And anyway, long story short, I woke up the next morning, I felt like I couldn't walk. And my Uncle Rob left Vegas, flew to me, drove my car back, and I was like very sick the whole way, vomiting all the way back to Vegas, got there, they put me on an IV drip. In the middle of the night, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I woke my brother up and I said, we need to go to the hospital. I think I'm going to die. And he was like, okay, you know, put your boots on, put your coat on. And I'm like, you don't understand. We got to go. And he took me to the hospital, this one called St. Rose. And, he let me out, went around to park the car, and he came back in. He said it was like a scene out of a movie. This one light at the end of the hallway was illuminated, and everybody was just rushing to this room. And then he saw, you know, the machine, and all of these people around talking. This one girl, later on he found out her name was Ruby, and she got on top of me and she was like pumping away, trying to get a heartbeat going, and he saw the thing go to 3 minutes. Finally, she got a heartbeat back. They transferred me from St. Rose to St. Martin, and they had to induce coma. I had complete organ failure. They cut my sides, put lung tubes in, cut a pericardial window, and my mom flew in from New York. They couldn't tell her anything if I was going to pull through or not. They didn't know what was wrong with me. And this went on for almost a month. I was there until New Year's 2020 when I finally got discharged. And they must have taken me off of whatever, you know, drugs they had me on. I was on the ventilator and I was on, you know, all these whatever they had me on. And I guess I like movies, right? And so the one guy came in from, you know, to do all of the brain tests, and they're like, you know, what's your name? And you know, how old are you? And, you know, who's the president of the United States? All of this. And when he asked me how old I was, I was like, I'm 97, but I look a lot younger. And it's a quote from Benjamin Button. So I thought that I was being so funny and that I was rattling off this, you know, something from the Benjamin Button, the movie. But the guy did not think it was funny, the doctor. And he was like looking like, oh God, this is not good. She might be gone. Anyway, that lasted for like a couple days. And I was talking like a child and I thought everything was so funny. It was bizarre. But I came out of that. Those drugs flushed themselves through my system. And then soon after that, I was discharged. But I was very, 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 very lucky.
One of the first cases of COVID in the United States.
Came on so hard and so fast and so strong.
Yeah. Did they tell you had COVID, or no one really knew what
they
it was?
They were baffled at what it was. And the only thing I had done differently that week was go to a rock climbing gym. Like an indoor rock climbing gym. I had never been to one before. My friend took me, and they probably don't really clean too much in those, you know, nooks. And that's, I don't know. I don't know where else it would have come from, but yeah.
Did your outlook on life change when you got out? You were 90 pounds when you got out of the hospital.
I had to relearn how to walk. I couldn't work because my brain was so cloudy, and I just, everything was new to me again, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't have an NDE, but they say that that can come back later in life, which is, who knows? Maybe I will, maybe I won't, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I had over $1 million in medical bills. I had lost my SAG insurance that year because I had a really bad year. And if you don't make, you know, if you don't make it 1 year, they kick you off. It's not like, oh, you had, you know, 2 years, 3 years in a row that like weren't good. It's like, no, you don't make the cut 1 year, you don't have insurance. And so I was switching over from SAG to Blue Shield or Blue Cross Blue Shield. Anyway, so I was looking at stacks of bills. I was seeing, you know, medical bills of over $500,000, $70,000, $200,000, I mean, just coming in, and it was so stressful. And I was just lucky to be alive. And I had to basically start over again.
Did you have a completely new outlook on life when you got home and said, I'm going to live? And how did that experience change your outlook?
I don't even think at that time that I was even, you know, really thinking. I was so grateful to be alive 100%, but I was literally trying to get up the first stair to get in my apartment, you know? I couldn't even walk up a whole set of stairs without getting winded. So it was like, wow, here I am. And I almost have to relearn everything as a child would, in a way. And I didn't know where I was going to go or what I was going to do or how I was going to make money or anything.
When I got out of the hospital, I got home. I thought, gosh, you know, I have a new outlook on life, and I just got on my friend's funeral, and I said, shit, like, all the aggravating stuff that happens, in our lives is irrelevant.
It's irrelevant, right?
My life's going to change. And then 3 months later, you go back to what you were doing and you kind of forget some of the lessons there.
But then you think, okay, you know, he brought me back for a reason, right? And what's my purpose? Like, did you have a greater found sense of purpose after that?
It was more of a, I'm grateful. You know, I was living my dream. You know, I had started a successful company and I was,
you take no day for granted, right?
No hour
for granted, because you don't know when it's going to go.
No, I was living in my dream house. I'd made a bunch of money.
Yeah.
You know, I had a wonderful family. You know, I had three young kids at the time, and just got to appreciate what you have. Sometimes you're just so far in the rat race, and I work long hours and very long hours. Today, even 70 hours a week, usually minimum, and it's sometimes.
But
just,
that's your choice.
That is a choice. It's for sure a choice, but it helps bring things back to reality and helps you focus on what's really important in life. And my family was the most important, and I just needed to slow down for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I did slow down for a while, but then I turned it back up into fifth gear maybe a few months later. That's just
who you are, right?
That's,
but it makes you appreciate the little things, and it makes
completely.
You appreciate the people around you.
Completely.
And that's what really means, you know, that's truly what life is, love and family and experiences and helping other people, right?
For sure. Let's talk about the life of being an actor. Everyone dreams at some point in their life or thinks about what it's like to be famous. And you go to the movies, you see yourself on the big screen, and you say, gosh, one day I'd love to do that. They think it's sexy. They think you make a lot of money. And they think it's easy.
Mm-hmm.
What's the reality?
None of those. I find it very hard to watch myself on screen. Although, like, I force myself to, because sometimes I feel like I learn from it. So I use it as, you know, a training ground in a way. But it's uncomfortable. A lot of times you don't get paid for what you do because it takes so many auditions to even book a single job, right? So say you're working for scale for the day. So you're working for $1,000, right? Just under $1,000. But maybe you've done 20 auditions, right? And put in 20 hours before that. So you're not making any money until you start to, you know, become a series regular and things, you know, one thing leads to the next and the next, and you test for network, and then your rate starts to go up. But there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that go into it, and you're working long hours, as you know. I mean, I think I did one day, I think we worked like, it was like golden hour. I mean, we went into like 22 hours. All through the night, you're tired, you can't even remember your name, let alone your lines. Sometimes you're working in inclement weather, all different things. It's not as sexy as people think. You know, they look at the outside and they think it's bright and it's shiny, but there's a lot beneath the surface.
So how many takes do you do in a movie? I mean, you're part of a scene, right? Let's say there's five people in the scene. How many times do people fuck up and it's not you and you got to recut the whole thing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it depends on the director. Some directors move quick and they figure out a way to cut around it or, you know, whatever. But they still have to get coverage, and it depends on how many cameras they're using. But, I mean, you could do, you know, five takes. You could do 17 takes. It depends. You could be there for a long time.
I'm going to be doing some paid corporate speaking on the topic of extreme preparation, which we're going to talk about in a couple minutes.
Okay.
And my speech is 39 pages.
Wow.
And
Yep,
I wrote it. It's an hour.
Are you memorized, or do you have a prompter?
I'm memorizing it.
Okay.
And it's taken me months. Months, maybe 6 months. I'm almost.
How do you even memorize that much?
Well, my question to you is going to be, how do actors memorize so many lines so quickly, especially when they're doing weekly shoots? I mean, I can see a movie where you've got months to prepare, but
Soap opera actors, usually they shoot over 100 pages a day. So a series regulars on soaps usually do about 20, 25 pages a day. On big action movies,
wait, they're memorizing that
every day.
How?
I don't know. It becomes like
how?
Like a muscle. You just do it.
There's no teleprompter anywhere on the set.
Nope.
I mean, some of these scenes
are. And they're shooting with a lot of different cameras, so they're getting every angle, so they can move quick.
So how do you do it?
Repetition. I'm not good at memorizing. For me, it depends, because if it's good writing, it's a lot easier to memorize than if it's, you know, not. or if you're in a show where there's a lot of medical jargon or things like that, and you don't know these terms, right? If it doesn't make sense in your brain, you're just repetition, repetition, repetition. That's the only way.
I mean, I went and shot a sizzle reel for my speaking website that we're going to do, and maybe I did 20 minutes of the sizzle reel, and my colleague Matt and I is over there, one of the producers of my show, who's awesome. We rented a stage in Santa Monica, the Santa Monica Theater. I'd go there and I would practice. Not only do you have to memorize it, but you have to make it seem natural. You got to get the inflection points right.
Yeah.
So it's not just memorizing it,
right?
Which is still difficult, but it's actually you're performing something with different people. It's hard.
But you can memorize it by, think of it like a story. Right? And so you can visualize what's going on. You can kind of remember those bullet points of how it transitioned, and then start to go back and fill in the gaps, right?
So what does it take to be successful, to be an actor, and are the elements the same to be successful in life?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I even still, I work, but I still don't feel like I've reached the level that I would like to get to. So I think it's this constant, you know, almost state of like dissatisfaction with myself that fuels the drive, because I think I can do better. I want to, you know, work with this director or work with this, you know, this actor or... I feel like it's about the climb, right? It's not the destination, it's the journey. And so I think a lot of those cross over into life, because I also have a very curious soul. I think you're kind of like that too. I think, you know, that fuels your entrepreneurial spirit. And I think there is a lot of crossover there.
What are the elements that it takes to be successful as an actor? And then...
I mean discipline.
Discipline.
A lot of discipline. Drive. Punctuality. If you're not early, you're late. Or if you're on time, you're late.
If you're early, you're on time.
If you're early, you're on time. That's what I meant.
Yeah. If you're on time, you're late.
The dyslexia is kicking in, yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What else? I think consistency.
I mentioned earlier in the show today that one of the ingredients or characteristics that's contributed to my success, probably the most important thing, is preparation, but not the kind of preparation most people think about, something they call extreme preparation. Mm. I'm writing a book by the same title, and that's going to be the topic of my paid corporate speaking, and I also do one-on-one coaching on it as well. I coach. Mm-hmm. I've coached professional athletes, I've coached young professionals, wealth managers, investment bankers.
And what do you tell all of them?
It's when someone prepares 1 hour for something, I'll probably prepare 20, right? My goal is to be the most prepared person who's ever walked into that room with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 99% successful. When you do that, you'll be able to achieve dramatically faster results that would not have been possible and which people think are impossible.
Do you believe you're lucky?
You create your own luck. Well, number one, yes. Of course I've been lucky. Mark Cuban was on my show and he said, you can't be a billionaire if you're not lucky. But I think every successful person has had luck. I mean, I've had a lot of people on my show. Most of them are incredibly humble, and most of them attribute some degree of luck to their success. Now, the flip side of that is you create your own luck. I mean,
yeah, if you didn't reach out to those people, if you didn't, you know, send those crazy presents,
I send the crazy presents. I send letters to 300 CEOs, got meetings with Sumner Redstone, Michael Eisner, the head of every studio, cold letters because my letter was different than any letter they'd ever received.
Did you write in your letter that was different?
It was a crazy letter. It started with a quote that the CEO had given at some point in their career. It was a big cursive letters. The key to Disney is how we hire. Michael Eisner, Time Magazine. I still remember June 21st, 1996. That was the cover. It had a plastic cover. I went on LexisNexis. There was no Google back then. And I created a list of 300 people. So Michael Eisner, Sumner Redstone, Mark Platt, Stacy Snyder, these people all ran studios at the time. Mike Medavoy, who I've since become friends with. You've probably met him.
Oh,
he's a great guy.
I've never met him.
And I incorporated every job they had ever had in their career into a single paragraph. And I basically said, you've done X, Y, I mean, A, B, C, D, and sometimes it went to W, but it was every job. I mean, every promotion, every this, every that. And then said, I want an informational interview, not a job interview, where a letter would find a shredder to talk about getting advice for how to transition from a legal to a business-related career.
Okay.
My letter had tabs. It had my single-space three-page letter. It had my transcripts from college. I did very well academically. I graduated top 1% of my class at Michigan. At Northwestern, I also did very well. I had letters of recommendations. And then I had this newspaper piece that had been written about me in college for a TV show, a weekly TV show. We were one and done, but there was a nice write-up. And then it had a cellophane cover and was wrapped in one of those small plastic spiral binders.
Wow.
And I got, and people said,
are you human? When I grow up, can I be like you?
Well, but these are all things, by the way, that I teach, and they're simple.
Okay.
Right? They're easy. You can do it. I've told you how to do it right now, right? And it's very easy. You create a spreadsheet of people you want to meet, you do your research, you create your, now it's easy, right? You got Google. It's so easy to do it right now, and nobody does it. I got a letter 3 days ago from this guy named Miguel Perez. I haven't met him yet. And he did a me. He sent me a letter in a cellophane cover that was tabbed that had everything I had in my letter. By the way, I've talked about it, but not a lot. Not the details. I mean, this is more detail than I've ever gone into on my show.
Wow.
All right? Period. But he did it. And he FedExed it, and he said, so this is easy too, right? You have a meeting, you want to send a thank you note, right? I'm going to send an easy email. It's easy, right? Why go easy? Do a handwritten thank you note. And yeah, we're on a Zoom when they're in New York. FedEx the thank you note. You spent all that time preparing for the interview or the meeting. It's $20.
Yeah.
For $20, you'll be the only person who's ever sent someone a FedEx thank you note. That person's gonna remember you forever. There's 100 people for that job. You know, my daughter worked at CAA last summer. I think they had like 6,000 applications for the summer for something like 40 jobs. You know, you gotta do people things that people don't do, right? FedEx the thank you letter. But, you know, I tell you about the letter writing campaign, it's easy. You just gotta be willing to do the work.
That's it.
And so you asked me about extreme preparation. I mean, each letter took 5 hours.
Yeah.
So you got so many people doing spray and pray, right? You send the same cover letter, you change the name, you change the company, and they say, oh my God, I spent so much time and no one responds to my application. Of course they don't. Who would respond to that application, right? Versus someone sends a crazy letter like that. You know, I called the guy yesterday, Miguel, and it went to voicemail, so I texted him. Doesn't have my number, and he texted me back. Oh my gosh, you know, Mr. Kaplan, I didn't think you would respond. I texted him back. How could anyone in the world not respond?
Yeah.
Right. It's a no-brainer. So my question to you is, flipping it around, how has extreme preparation played a role in the success in your life?
I don't think that I would have been able to climb the ladder, so to speak, if I hadn't done that work. I don't think I would have been able to, you know, attract that team or get in the rooms with those casting directors to then get those jobs if I didn't do that work.
Give me an example of a time where you used extreme preparation, just went so far above and beyond anybody else, and you had a successful outcome.
I have to think about that.
We'll come back to that one.
I have to think about that. That's a good question. I like that. Are you going to be my mentor? Are you my mentor now?
by the way, one of the great things about my show that I love is a lot of people like you, who I didn't know, Sharon Stone, and the Tysons, Mike and Kiki, his wife, I've become close to and friends with. And they've done so many nice things for me, and I like doing nice things for them. So I've mentored a lot of my, my guests. They mentor me, and they teach me about things that I know nothing about. They're doing me huge favors by being on my show, helping me grow my show. Mm-hmm. They do super nice things like post. Mike Tyson put up a permanent post on his Instagram, not a story, but a permanent post. I mean, he's got 40 million followers. That's incredible.
Oh, yeah.
You know, doesn't have to do that. And there's nothing for the Tysons that I wouldn't do.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And it's been fun. But I love mentoring people. I love coaching people. Oh, I love it.
Really?
Which is one of the goals of my show.
Yeah, and you can see the results, right? You can see them grow.
It's immediate.
Wow.
We have some guy, Christian, I'm not going to mention your last name, reach out to me on Instagram. He said, I listen to your show. He's a dentist in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He's making mid six figures, comfortable, okay. Pediatric dentist, international violinist at age 14.
Wow.
Full from Brazil. Full ride to Yale, full ride to Harvard, and then full ride to Tufts. Dentistry, and he said, I've listened to your show, and I want you to coach me. And
you seem like you have it kind of. Well, you're doing all right there.
I'm sitting there thinking, you should coach me. Yeah. I mean, your resume is pretty awesome. And you know, we got on the phone, and I'd never done paid coaching before, right? I've been very generous with my time, but also, I always want to give more than I get. So someone is doing me a favor, being on my show. Being on my show, someone does something nice for my kids. I mean, that's the ultimate, right? There's nothing I wouldn't do for that person. And I always want to give more than I get. But in some cases, I am incredibly busy. I don't have a lot of time for myself. I have 5 kids, an amazing wife.
How do you manage it all?
You know, I work 7 days a week and not full days. I'm up early. When my wife goes to bed, I'll sometimes go down to my office. You know, but I'm lucky. I love what I do, but Christian caught in, and I didn't even know what to price it at. So I set it extremely high. I'm not going to tell you.
Because
I don't want to be a lawyer. It's like if he wants to do it. If he doesn't want to do it, I don't need it, right?
Yeah, he's like, okay, I'll do it.
Well, I threw it out there. I'm like, and he's like, okay, done. Said, all right, send me the check, 5 sessions, and I'll say it this way: he's going to do a promo reel for my website, which we're going to send a film crew out there, and he's grateful. But the truth is, and I say this in a very humble way, he said, you know, when I met you, I had no net worth. I was making $500,000 a year, $450,000 to be exact, and a year and a half, I'm now worth $10 million, and it was just a few little tweaks and advice about his business and what he should do and starting a new practice that was very helpful to him. So I take joy in it, and the results of extreme preparation are 99% successful.
That's incredible.
99%.
And you're still his mentor to this day?
Yeah, I mean, he's had a lot of success. My team, Matt, Ricky, who also I work with, who's one of my mentees, and now he's mentoring me in a lot of things, was a former intern. You know, we all met with them, and they're going to help me with my show, help me with my coaching business, and some other things that I'm doing. So tell us about the improv group and what your motto is.
Don't think. I went to Upright Citizens Brigade, UCB, and that is the motto, don't think, you know, just jump, go for it.
So it doesn't make sense to analyze the situation, just jump right in and kind of put your blinders on?
I think it's a mix. I think the way that you work is very detailed and very admirable, and I respect that so much. And I think sometimes as an artist, to be able to prepare but then let it all go, I think there's freedom in that. So I think a combination, I would say.
What are your goals with your career and in your life?
Oh, there's a lot. How much time do we have? I met Taylor Sheridan at a Cowboys game a couple months ago, and I had read this. I went up to him and I said, I read that article. I think it was in Variety or the Hollywood Reporter or something, and he was a broke actor living in his car, and he went from that to building this empire of Yellowstone. And because of my Christian background and whatnot, I'm very interested in Yellowstone or 1923, all of the whole Yellowstone series. But he said, I learned pretty quick that you've got to create your own destiny. And so that's what he did. But to be a series regular in a show like Yellowstone, or to be in the Marvel universe, to do any of those big tentpole movies, would be incredible. I've got a laundry list of directors that I want to, you know, work with: Tarantino, Spielberg, Aronofsky, Woody Allen. There's a ton. Family life. I'd love to get married and have a family. What else?
You're single?
Yeah, seeing somebody right now.
Okay.
But not married.
Okay. Yeah. So I don't have a lot of famous friends. It's hard to crack into, you know, they're not going to call your manager and they don't have your phone number, but no offense to the guy that you're dating, but the way that people meet people is DM.
Yeah. Slide up in the DMs.
What's that?
Slide up in those DMs. Yeah.
Slide to the DMs. So Joe Russo is going to do my show, so I'm very grateful for Joe to do it. I'm very excited. He did all the Marvel movies.
Oh, nice.
Second most successful director in history behind Spielberg, the Russo brothers.
Really?
So I'm excited to have him on my show. That's going to be a
How
great
did you
line.
Guys meet?
We're neighbors up in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho.
Okay.
And there's
a group. Oh, it's beautiful up there.
It's so nice. There's a group table at a restaurant in our residential complex, and they seat you with people. At picnic tables. I mean, it's
kind
a nice
random?
Picnic table. Yeah, random. They see
okay,
you.
Okay, that's cool.
I'm sitting next to them, and you know, just people don't really talk about work there. I mean, no one does. I mean, people there are generally where we live. It's a nice place. They're well to do, and you've got, you know, the Kardashians are in the neighborhood and Bieber's in the neighborhood. But you know, beyond them, it's like people are just regular people. They're regular people up there,
yeah.
Right? No one's taking photos, and we're sitting there, and Jesse's with his kids, and I'm with Madison, my wife, and we're just talking. And he said, you know, what do you do? And there was a guy next to him from Nashville who was a friend of his who was in town, and they said something about movies. I said, oh, are you? He's like, yeah, I'm a director. And I said, oh, you know, have you done anything that I would know? When I asked him, I mean, I felt like an idiot when I went back and he Googled him. But I Googled him because he told me what he had done.
Okay.
And I said, oh my gosh, you know, this, so he was so humble. So I thought it was great.
So you like want to be in the show?
I didn't ask him, and he didn't ask me. We're going to conclude here. I always end my podcast with something I call fill in the blank to excellence. Are you ready to play?
Ready to play.
The biggest lesson I've learned in my life is?
Be kind.
My number one professional goal is?
There's so many. To be in the Marvel Universe.
My number one personal goal is?
To get married and have a family.
My biggest regret is?
I don't have any regrets.
The thing in my life that I'm most proud of is?
My relationships with people.
If I could land any part in a TV or movie today, the part would be?
James Bond.
The one thing I've dreamt of doing for a long time but haven't is?
Winning an Oscar.
If you could go back and tell your 21-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Be nicer to yourself.
The one question you wish I'd asked you but didn't is?
Wait, what?
The one question you wish I had asked you but didn't is?
I don't know. You are the most prepared person I've ever met in my life, and you are amazing, and I am blown away. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you.